theory.
No.
I'm just meant. I have evolved a theory that something resembling the encapsulating process which the body uses against TB happens in the mind. The attention tends to approach and then build a wall around areas containing uncomfortable engrams. Why dwell in it, we say? An exercise based on extreme contraction and release will break these walls and release energy. Right will issues and ideas which have been isolated will suddenly associate into a clear pattern. But the energy released appears to have a content of anger, resentment, etc., and will seek a target. Many myths seem to suggest there is a catch in it, for example, King Midas, and we don't get what we expect. How can we learn to use this gold and prevent it doing damage internally or externally? Or shouldn't we care? This idea of encapsulation of unpleasant experiences, of course, isn't a new one. It's precisely what has always been meant by psychologists when they talk about repressed elements and inhibition. And it's what Gurdjieff means by buffers. The encapsulating process is simply setting up energy around any engrams, any ideas or feelings engrammed in our tissues, which might express themselves in unpleasant antisocial actions. It is quite obvious that if we get a good idea, a kind, humane idea, socially acceptable, that we have no need to inhibit it. And automatically, that which is socially acceptable would tend to be released. And so we are not very likely to inhibit, to bury socially useful instincts and their expressions. So the things that we tend to inhibit will naturally be those that are antisocial, destructive, as anger and resentment. So we shouldn't be surprised when we find an encapsulated, uncomfortable engram being released, expressing itself in anger, considering what was inhibited in the first place was anger. If we imagine that is a man's mind, nice shape mind that one, and we place in that mind some idea with its attendant feeling, which is destructive of some external being or situation, and we realize that as finite beings we haven't the power to strike out against society successfully, because society would hit back and restrict us, then naturally we'll inhibit it through fear. If we were omnipotent, we couldn't get angry in any case, because anger, if we remember, is a state in which we get blocked. Energy, motion blocks and then breaks out in disintegrating forces. You know this root, the ang in anxiety and the German angst or fear, tells you that energy is moving and becoming blocked, that is becoming encapsulated, inhibited. Now obviously we don't wish to inhibit through fear something that is socially acceptable. So when we do inhibit, it is probable that the inhibition will be caused by our fear of consequences. We can fill the mind with little encapsulated unpleasant ideas about a variety of subjects. As many subjects as there are, you will have some attitudes towards, half of which will be unpleasant ones, because we've said before, to affirm a pleasant thing is to affirm the unpleasant simultaneously. because the two horns, the dilemma, belong together. You can't get rid of the other end of the stick. If we imagine the simplest kind of relationship between two beings, then if this one likes the other being's presence, then it must try to rope the other being into a relation. But he can only like that other being for certain reasons. He couldn't like that being to such a point as wishing to absorb the being until the being disappeared completely. Because if he did so, then there would be no possibility of a relation. Hence, thus far, no father in every relation. You like somebody to a certain extent for certain reasons, and you bring them to you for those reasons, and if they come closer than you want them to come, then the antipathy, the anti-feeling, is generated. Now, this polarity of feeling is a necessity, an essential, an unavoidable. It is because of this polarity of feeling and the fact that pleasure and pain are simultaneous, one expressed and the other repressed, that Adam was told not to eat of that fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and to try to separate good from evil, and try to get one without the other. They're actually inseparable. If that is a young man and that is a girl, if he goes towards the girl, it is for some reason. Now the girl also has her reasons, which he is not interested in. And when she begins to express her reasons, there arises an antipathy. If his desire is strong enough, for the time being, it will obscure in her those elements which he doesn't want to see. And then later on, by the law of the tiring of the organism, it must follow that the things that have been expressed will lapse, and the things not expressed will appear. So in proportion as she has been pleasant, she must become unpleasant. That is a law. Some sages are trying to escape this law by saying, well, stay with her while she's pleasant and run away when the unpleasant period starts, and wait for the pleasant period to start again and then return. Well, most people have too many economic pressures on them to behave in this manner, and so they have to face it even when the unpleasant reaction is coming. The important thing to realize is that you cannot separate out this pleasure pain into two separate substances and throw one away. Therefore you must have both. Now, if you have here a finite being with finite power, there is something he cannot do. And yet, when he moves into a relation with other beings, because he is not omnipotent, he cannot make the relation go 100% the way he wants it to go. Therefore, there must be something in the relation he doesn't like. And because, in general, that thing which he doesn't like is unpleasant to look at, he doesn't want to look at it during the period of the relation. Therefore, he puts a wall of energy around it. That energy wall effectively stops the appearance in consciousness of that element. That energy wall is this capsule in the theory. Mr. Wilson's theory of the encapsulation of unpleasant experiences. Now, when by concentration upon it, hitting it, penetrating through it, by force of will, energy is piled into it until it breaks out again, then we have to face the fact, as Mr. Wilson has pointed out here, the thing that bounces out is resentment. Hence the last bit of this, or shouldn't we care? When this resentment comes out, we should be very glad, because it is that resentment that is creating disease in the organism. As long as it is bottled up and not faced. Let's do another diagram of this brain, in which we'll deliberately cut a segment out, and we'll put one of these encapsulated zones there, and we'll put repressive forces around it so that it cannot express itself into the waking consciousness. Nevertheless, it exists, and it is continuously turbulating, and is being driven into a center. Now, you know the rule about energy driven into a center. If you keep driving it in, it becomes tumescent and shoots out. Now, if you don't allow it to shoot into the waking consciousness, and it is being driven in because it is not non-existent, it is a real force, it drives into the center and then shoots down into the tissue. It is now energy literally destroying tissue because you have not allowed it out into expression. Now you can see why we shouldn't care. Caring, chiefly for opinion of other people, has caused us to repress, to encapsulate these unpleasant but essential emotions that appear in any relation. Caring, remember that care is the same thing as the car root, to control, to relate, to inhibit. Control implies inhibition. Caring for the opinion of other people has caused you to repress half of your emotive reaction. If you never like to express itself, either to the other people or to you, then it must drive into the center and eventually shoot into the tissue and proceed to disrupt it. Because there is no way whereby the tissue can absorb that energy other than that way devised by nature for the absorption of it through the special channels, through the digestive organs, through the blood, and so on. If the energy gets directly into the tissue from a repressed element, then it must act in a disintegrating manner. Now, you probably remember Grotius' statement about the man that had to blow the buzzer in the morning and get everybody out of bed, and how he felt very, very ill for a long time until it suddenly occurred to him that people didn't like him. You remember the occasion, the stimulus that gave him that? He was out in the street and he saw a dog catcher just about to catch a dog, and suddenly a stimulus came and the dog escaped the net, and he then cursed the stimulus. And immediately this man, the buzzer blower man, realized that when he blew that buzzer in the morning, people disturbed from sleep curse him. And he said, that is the cause of my feeling so ill, so I will beat them to it. So every morning before he blew the buzzer, he first roundly cursed everybody who was about to be disturbed, and thus released all the energy. Now, Gurdjieff had a sense of humour, and there's no necessity to curse everybody in that way. But there's a very real necessity for you to become conscious of the tendency, the necessary tendency of you to curse everybody, simply because you are in relation with them. You know there's a peculiar thing called egotism. You know that peculiar thing called... Am I going the wrong way?
No.
That peculiar thing called egotism has a very, very deep root. It is rooted in spirit. It is not an invention of man. It is rooted in spirit because spirit is free initiative. When the spirit is not enclosed, it is not egotistic. But when that same spirit comes in and goes round, the moment it has closed that circle, because here it was free initiative, now it is initiative bound. It's the same quality as before, free initiative, but now it has bound itself and its initiative goes inside itself and works to organize its being. And when its organization is complete, then it tries to relate itself to other beings who have done the same thing from the same source. Consequently, it follows that every finite being has a center of free initiative and must, from its origin, its spiritual origin, will freely to do what it wants. It must decide what it is going to do. And any suggestion that a stimulus from another being could determine its condition must be resisted. We often find in a relation, you know, the rabbis said you can't go to heaven unless you get married. And the reason was, Kierkegaard agreed with them, only the married man, he said, is complete, because only the married man is under test sufficiently. When the stimulus of the wife comes to the husband, it comes at unpredictable and irregular times and disturbs his inner process of conceptualizing a situation. Therefore, he tends to hit back at it, and if he doesn't understand it, he actually hopes that someday she will stop this interruption. Now, if there were no other beings external to that man at all, we've said before, he could not ever become a full person. Because you can only become a full person if you can find a reciprocal point, a point that will return your energies back to you so that you can see what they are. A woman cannot understand what it is to be a woman except in relation to a man. A man cannot understand what it is to be a man except in relation to a woman. There must be something to return to mirror his activities, just in the same way that the sun, without the moon to shine on, cannot understand itself as a sun. So the conflict, the confrontation, as the philosophers might call it, of two beings is an essential part of the development of each. And yet both derive from free spirit, from free initiative, and are brought into limitation, to circumscription, by the free initiative will, and therefore they have self-determination in them from their very root. Self-determination is not superadded to the finite, it is from its original infinite source, and therefore you can never kill the will to self-determination. You can convince it in a finite situation that it cannot yet get its own way, but you cannot convince it that it could never get its own way. Even if you put a man in jail with thick walls and convince him that he's in jail with thick walls, the center of free initiative in himself, if you don't watch him, will start biting the walls with his teeth, if he's got nothing else, to get out, because he has from the spirit this initiative. Now, when people don't understand the nature of this conflict, because they have repressed the antisocial or the anti-other impulse, which must necessarily exist because of the nature of spirit, that is free initiative, when those elements have been repressed, then there arises the pseudo-humane social relation, the conceptual relation, which says that people ought to be nice to each other. That comical kingdom of God that some church people mention, where everybody would be, if they were, very nice to each other. Now that can never arise until people admit the essential polarity, the thus far and no farther, that in every relation there is not only a value gained, but there is also a restriction in the relation. And the free spirit must resent the restriction of the relation whilst pursuing the value of the relation. Now you have to make yourself conscious of this fact. Then you will understand why anger springs out of every encapsulated, inhibited concept that you've ever had. It springs out because it was that which was inhibited. And the original character of a memory trace is still in the memory as its quality. If it is anger you repress, or resentment, or fear, then those are the qualities which must emerge when it finds expression. So we have to understand that we must accept plus and minus, positive and negative, in every relation as absolutely inseparable, and know, therefore, that in your relation with other beings, there is something you don't like, exactly as strong as the thing you do like. Not less strong, but exactly as strong. And if you can move towards the thing you like, with the thing that you don't like in full consciousness, you are acting freely. Whereas, if you move towards the thing that you do like, having repressed the part you don't like, then later on, as you tire, which is necessary because the organism intoxicates itself with the byproducts of its own activities, as you tire, then the energy repressed will manifest and the loved object will be the hated object. This is a fact that every psychologist and every mystic knows, that love and hate are equal and opposite and apply to the same object. So necessarily, the thing that you love is the thing that you hate to the same degree. If the social taboo requires you not to hate, that is pseudo-religion, pseudo-Christianity, then you will inhibit it, and later on it will hit you. And you will think you were mistaken in that person, instead of mistaken in your analysis of life. So you have to affirm that these are aspects of one functional fact. Love and hate are exactly equal and opposite for the same object at the same moment. In the most intimate of all relationships, if you are conscious of your feeling, you will always find exactly the same amount of repulsion that you find of attraction. And if you just accept that fact, you will stop repressing, stop inhibiting, stop encapsulating these things, and then, not being inhibited, they cannot later shock you by the violence with which they appear. Now, when we encapsulate a force which was this big, actually it was infinite, but you bring it in, as you become aware of your violence towards the loved object, you drive it in, to make it unconscious. And eventually you drive it as far as you can do and put your inhibiting forces around it to stop it bouncing out. Now the energy locked in there is exactly like the energy compacted in a bomb. That energy is field energy which was spread out and which when it was originally spread out you could assimilate. And if you are conscious of it before it has time to compress, it can never compress. And if it can't compress, it can't explode and give you a shock. This is the important thing about inhibition. Inhibition compresses a thing in order to cause it not to be. But it can never cause a thing absolutely not to be. So all it does is drag in the field energies to a very, very small compass and hold them in as long as you have sufficient energy outside to hold them in. But the time always comes that either a shock from outside disturbs your equilibrium, or simply the advance of years robs you of the energy needed to keep in this inhibited center. This is why you find very, very old people manifesting these peculiar attitudes toward people, which are really things repressed 40, 50, 60 years ago, and which now bounce out. If they had been conscious of them in the first place and accepted them as essential polar opposites of the good qualities, then they could never have been compressed and they would still be spread in the field and they could never explode. There can be no explosion without a previous implosion. So we see that really this question is a very, very valuable one because it allows us to reconsider more fully the kind of work we have to do. When you hammer into any unpleasant idea in yourself, when you find anything you don't want to look at, and you deliberately concentrate on it and force yourself to look at it, because it was a thing you didn't want to look at, therefore you know it was an inhibited thing. Therefore you know that fundamentally it is a thing not acceptable outside. It is antisocial. It is breaking the taboo. Therefore, when you penetrate into it, it must explode. And you must feel surging out of yourself this anger, this aggression. And you must say, or shouldn't we care? This you must say. Now, the important thing to realize is this. You can never gain equilibrium unless you allow these repressed elements to express themselves. But you mustn't allow them to come outside and damage people that you have been deliberately avoiding damaging for so long. So what you have to do is expect that it will be anger, fear, rage, resentment, treason, and all sorts of horrible things that you discover when you take the capsule. Don't be surprised and recognize that is what was in the pot when you put the lid up. Don't identify it. Let it bob out and say so, so, so. If you had a very close friend, you might actually say to that close friend, would you mind if I tell you what I've been inhibiting about you for the last 25 years? If he's a very good friend, he won't mind. When I did this to a friend of mine about 4 years ago, when he was in a very tight way, and I said to him, you go and write down exactly what you think about me, and I won't mind. And he said, I'm nothing against you. I said, nevertheless, go and write down whatever comes, and on no account interfere with it. Well, he wrote down for 4 hours a lot of words about me. Most of them were 4 letters. And he was amazed. He was a Methodist, this boy. And he was amazed that there were so many rude words in his vocabulary. I was amazed that there were so few, so often repeated.
If he had not been a Methodist, he would have had more of them.
The point was that they were released, and he felt better afterwards. Now, you can only become whole if you spread out your energies to where they came from. They came from equilibrated absolute spirit. They must be returned to that spirit. This is the meaning of throwing your sins onto the shoulders of Christ. He will bear them. You can throw all your sins back to where they came from, because that's where they belong. Because they are inherent in the fact of spirit creating. The spirit is free and absolutely guiltless. Then the spirit creates. And the moment the spirit goes like that, there is goo up to the ilt. That's guilt. When this gullible will is crucified on the fact of existence, that is called guilt. But there is no guilt other than spirit creating. And in the act of creating, creating guilt. Because to be finite, when one is free, the initiative, when one can, from one's own source of absolute spirit, be self-determinant. To be finite under such conditions is necessarily to be guilty. Because immediately one wills from one's finity, from one's creativeness, one must, in relation to other beings, be a nuisance. And that must be accepted. You are a nuisance to every other being in the universe, and they are nuisances to you. Nothing can be done about that fact except to accept the fact. Just like all the men in all the cars all over the country try to accept the fact that there are other cars on the road by going round them instead of through them. A sick person is a person who is aware in general that they are about to go through people instead of round them. And at that moment they usually go as voluntary patients to try to get rid of this regression to aggression. If previously they had been aware that this must arise and accepted it, then it could never have arisen. Because the precondition of it is that we must take field energy from spirit, drive it in, and try to compress it till it becomes invisible. And in the act of the compression, we are driving it in and down into our tissue. And it must find its way out when the inhibiting forces round it tire, weaken, as they must do either when you are slightly off colour or when you grow older, naturally.
Now, is that fairly clear? Are there any immediate questions about that?
Yes, I have one. There's a confessional sacrament in the RC Church. Is that why it has so much value? Because it all the things we inhibit are the reason.
Yes. It was expressly designed for that. And the very early church knew that they were dealing with primitive levels of energies repressed. And if they wanted to make a church, an ecclesia, a commune of people, an assembly, the mere fact that they were causing beings of free initiative to gather together in one place would either produce violent blows, as it must do in a closed situation, like a church, which is an assembly, simply. Then they said, well now, to get rid of these repressed energies, we must institute a method of release. Therefore, they must go to the episcopos, the bishop, the father, the leader, and say, I am Albert, I felt like hitting Sammy very hard today. And he says, yes, my son, you sure did. And I also felt like hitting Sammy. But you see, we're always going to feel like hitting Sammy. Sammy is the kind of fellow that causes people to feel like hitting them. And then he said, oh, so I'm not alone. The energy was played out. And that was the purpose of the confessional. It is exactly the same function that modern psychology has. Modern psychology is just a secular confessional. Where it succeeds, it has actually persuaded the patient to speak forth these deep resentments. Where it fails, it has actually failed to penetrate to certain resentments in them. Another amusing case recently where a patient I know was sued by a psychiatrist for causing a breach of the peace in the surgery, and has recently appealed against this decision and is conducting the defence of her own case. She had a very strange statement to make. She said she was at war with all psychiatrists because they were always trying to pry into the depths of her mind. That's the important thing about it. She resented that. She had lots of feelings, anti-psychiatric feelings, but nevertheless she was driven into relation with them because of the polarized fact. And these resentments she was determined never to voice. And they can't cure her until she admits those things. She has invoked the name of justice, that people shouldn't pry into other people's minds. So she's suffering from a concept that she is an isolated individual, and that a psychiatrist is another person, also isolated, and that there is no right in that person to penetrate that person, which means that her spiritual education is deficient. If she knew that one spirit went like that, and that the right is of this spirit to penetrate that and that, and if the psychiatrist knew that spirit was what he was dealing with, free initiative, and said, well, inside you there is a natural resentment for me, and I resent you too for being ill and wasting my time. Nevertheless, the amount of recompense I get from you for wasting time makes it worth my while. Now, open statements of that order produce underneath of this indicative element. So the confessional, as the name tells you, is named a with doing. It is a with doing. Let us all confess that we are all, as finites, equally criminal. We are all, as rooted in spirit, free initiative. We are all, as creatures, limited, and must resent our limitations. And simply because the absolute spirit has produced many set centers,
And these centres are all centres of free initiative. And any one of them can do what it likes, because it is the spirit. And if anyone can do what it likes, they all can. And if they all can, there's no reason why a lot of them shouldn't gang up to stop one of them doing what it wants. That is the relation we have to face. This is the internal dialectics of spirit. Heraclitus himself was the first of the Greeks to formulate that. That the spirit is essentially that which can form and unform, and will form for some purpose, for some time, and then will go on, leave it, and it will disintegrate, it won't bother with it, and it will make another form. And therefore, he said, really, the only rule worth knowing is this dialectical rule, that there aren't any rules. That anything can happen, that free initiative, spirit, wills to happen. That must be accepted. And if it wills are finite, it immediately constrains itself. And if it doesn't like the constraint, it will have to undo itself. But if it wills a constraint, which is a Christian analysis, and says in spite of the horriblenesses and the polar dialectics and the love, hate, antithesis in every being, nevertheless it is worth my while to will it, because the alternative is wandering eternally in a maze that never makes anything. And of the two processes, the Christian psychology prefers that analysis, the affirmation of being, as opposed to the non-affirmation of being, the crazy eternal wandering of Ahasuerus to wandering Jew. We have to choose between being and not being. The Christian analysis says you must choose being. But if any very lazy people, and very tired people, and very, very sick people get fed up with being and are prepared to lapse into non-being, when they do so, it is their choice. They will it. When they will to lapse into non-being, they're doing a foolish thing, whether they know it or not. Because once they've become mazy again, any one of these beings, becoming conscious, can actually go through certain processes and capture that lazy energy and bring it into itself. That is what actually we do when we're eating things. The earth has captured mazy energies. The plants have captured them. The animals have captured them. Man has captured them. So all this hazy, mazy business can be captured by beings who are conscious. So if a man is unbecoming, in a real sense, he's becoming manure to a man who's willing to become.
When you release this energy from these buffers, if you don't handle it correctly, you can actually have the same thing happen to you all over again. Is that so?
Oh, yes.
And that is the real danger of this business. If you don't handle it in the correct manner, you just revert it in a way.
Well, you will revert every time you do not accept that every inhibited element must have the qualities deserving inhibition. So they won't be nice qualities.
But the only way you can handle these qualities is to observe.
Is to observe them and not to identify them. And to see that they are necessary results of the fact of inhibition. If you know, if you started today and said, all the people I know, I hate them as much as I love them, and I love them as much as I hate them. Equal and opposite. And there is no indifference. So all your friends are your enemies, and all your enemies are your friends, actually, simultaneously. And you affirm this, so you can never feel let down by a so-called friend, because he is your enemy. And you can never be fully annoyed with your enemy, because he'll do you a good turn.
But we still have to live in a society, don't we?
The society is full of your friend enemies. It's other people who are in exactly the same boat as yourself. If somebody bounces at you and becomes angry, you should say immediately they have inhibited part of their real attitude towards me, and now it has come out because they're a bit tired.
This is complete understanding of the cause of Pan Cause, of course.
Yes, of course.
So you can prevent the manufacture of buffers by the use of the magic circle, is that?
Yes.
By constant observation of what's coming in and what's going out.
Yes.
You are preventing that happening.
Yes. And making sure that you do not try to split good and evil and throw the evil away. A man said to me last night, a Methodist, that the Bible said that God is love, and that's all he stood on. I said, it says in the Bible, am I not he who gives good and gives evil, saith the Lord? And the man said, well, I would like to know what the reference is for that, because I don't accept it. Now, it's quite easy to find that statement. When I said, I will give you the reference, he said, well, perhaps the word shouldn't be translated evil there, it should be translated punishment. Then the other word should be translated reward. Anyhow, I said, I'll bring you the reference and the original Hebrew word, and you can evaluate it yourself. And he said, well, I couldn't accept it, because I'm sure that it can't mean evil. I then told him the myth of the Garden of Eden and how Adam and Eve were thrown out for dividing the good and the evil and trying to throw the evil away. And he said he never understood it before, but he felt terrible about attributing evil to God. Now, God is absolute, so if there is anything whatever, it hangs upon him. And therefore, at least by allowing it to hang on him, he's responsible for it. He is spirit, he is free initiative. When he breathed spirit into man, and man became a freely initiated being, then at that moment God had brought into being a responsible being that could commit evil. Now, who is responsible? The man who invents the bomb or the bomb? If there is any responsibility in a man, it belongs to spirit. Although man, as a finite, has to pay a finite price, there is also an infinite price. That is to say, there is a reverberation to the absolute, as well as within the finite. Yes. Eckhart, the great mystic, knew this when he said that if I didn't exist, God wouldn't exist either. Because he knew very well that if that didn't exist, and that is the worshipper of this, this couldn't exist. Because to state that that is transcendent depends upon saying this is immanent. If we destroy immanence, we destroy that, and only that, which can say there is a transcendence. So if we destroy all the worshippers, there will be no God. Because God is the object of a worshipper. So there would only be an absolute with no other name. Therefore, that spirit, in bringing to be, is responsible for the being he brings to be. And it is because of this, in Christianity, it is said that that absolute being, which makes all these little beings, takes upon his shoulders all the guilt of all the little ones. Every error that they make belongs to the macrocosmic being, because it made first itself and then all the parts internal to it. If I get a knife and stick it in my arm, I am more responsible than the arm for the knife sticking in it. So I should apologize to the cells. I shouldn't tell my cells to look where they were going. The fact that they are finite, more limited than I am, places them in passive relationship to me. If I can educate a little cell into reflexive self-consciousness and then threaten it with a knife, it would dodge. The lectern is a slight tendency in tissue to try to move away. If you deliberately put a knife near it and threaten to stick it in, you feel a little cringe in that place. There's that much initiative in a cell that it can at least fear and draw back from it, contract. If you put an acid on the cell, it will start to shrink. It has that much initiative.
He was quite marked in shark flesh.
Yes.
Easiest to see that.
You can see it in many animals. If you take a piece of tissue out and isolate it and treat that, shows his marked responsibility.
When you're reducing these buffers, then you're actually working in the causal in relation to your physical health.
Yes, of course you are. Remember, your field is infinite. The field of every finite being is infinite. And there are not two infinites, which means an absolute identity of us as spirit. Hence Christ saying, as he is one with the Father, so we should be one with each other. Our finite, created, rotating force bodies are the things that cause the problems to arise. And as long as we believe that they're absolutely finite, we create problems which are insoluble. Remember, your field is infinite. The field of every finite being is infinite. And there are not two infinites, which means an absolute identity of us as spirit. Hence Christ saying, as he is one with the Father, so we should be one with each other. Our finite, created, rotating force bodies are the things that cause the problems to arise. And as long as we believe that they're absolutely finite, we create problems which are insoluble. But if we understand that all these finite bodies are merely modalities of the infinite spirit, then there is no problem of ultimate enmity, because all is non-dual free initiative in which there is no enmity. Enmity appears where there is identification with the finite. So to get rid of it, all you have to do is remember your absolute origin. See that it is so, believe it is so. And to believe is an act of will.
This is the statement again about judgment, isn't it? Judge not, lest ye be judged.
Yes. Because if you judge another being, if you judge that being that is bad, you have an image inside your mind of that being as a bad being. And you don't like bad, so you inhibit it. So you actually say, I don't want to think about that man. So every adverse judgment you make against another being actually means that you have encapsulated that man's image in yourself. In other words, you have created the conditions of disease simply by being against that person outside. When Paul was talking about strong meat, he was talking about free initiative. He said, here is some milk and water. There is strong meat, and you cannot yet bear it. So he didn't tell them. In the same way, Christ said something to Thomas, and Thomas wouldn't tell the others. In every language, there's a key to that statement. Some strong meat there. Every meat is me at. That is, it is the objective aspect, the M is the substantial, of the spirit. That is he, that spirit, and me. That's body, the objective and spirit. So that's he, and that's me. And that's the cross, the at, the location. Now the strong meat that Paul wouldn't tell, because if he had have done, they could never have made a church, was this. Every being in the universe, including a subatomic particle, if it can do it, is entitled to do it. If it can do it. Only the true function determines the right. Therefore, if any free initiative being brings itself into being, it becomes meat, a substance on which that spirit will feed. Feed in the sense it will derive experience from it. And wherever it drives that me, that objectified he, into whatever situation, Some experience will be derived whereby that he will derive joy from the experience. But he will have to drive that me, that finited substance, into situations involving other me's. Now, the world is full of me's, and they're all at different levels of understanding, and they were in Paul's day. And if he had tried to make all those me's understand at the same rate, the same ultimate truth, he would have failed, and he would have introduced anarchy, because anarchy is the same thing as absolute self-determination. So you cannot make a hierarchy, a church, a pyramid, or a state, if you teach anarchy to the unprepared, because they will not freely cooperate in the building of that pyramid, because they will have other purposes, namely their own evolution, because they too must drive themselves into situations. And only in the painful situation can you derive the greatest value. Now, in an established state, the situation gets less and less painful. It becomes a welfare state if you don't stop it, which means, in effect, that every person will get fed and get his television, whatever it is, and he will become comfortable. He will become satisfied, and then he will die in his sins, as it says in the Bible. That is, his comfort mechanism will get him, and he cannot improve. He cannot rise to the heights of reflexive self-consciousness. If he is told in the beginning that he is a free being with the right to do what he wants, he will always do originally the pleasant thing and dodge the painful. Therefore, that strong meat that everybody is entitled to make up his own mind from his inner spirit could not be taught, because it would produce anarchy. When Augustine, with the collapsing Roman Empire there, saw it, he saw that if a new unity wasn't made quickly, the thing would completely disintegrate and the Goths would take over. The only possibility of unity was with the church. So he put his energies in the church. And the church then stood as the nucleus round which that state could reorganize itself. But the reorganization cost the initiative of the individuals, and a dogmatic hierarchy was set up determining exactly what should be thought below the pontifical chair. Now, the fact that they succeeded is their justification. If anybody down below could revolt and bounce up there, that would also be justified. But that is strong meat. That is revolutionary talk, and we don't want any revolutionary talk. We certainly don't want the waste of energy that is involved in a social revolution where people rush about in the streets breaking windows and stealing canned bananas or something from each other, instead of going into unpleasant situations to develop their understanding. The kind of social revolution conducted in France and Russia has not elevated the understanding and the spiritual level of the people involved in that revolution. It simply offered them something that they hadn't got in a mass movement. And yet spirit can only be developed by individuals and by individual effort. 70 million Frenchmen can be wrong. One individual Frenchman might be right. And certainly only one and one and one can succeed in becoming spiritual, precisely because spirit is free initiative. And when it makes an individual, that individual, in order to be spiritual, must retain its initiative. And a social revolution of the order of the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution does not produce individual free initiative. It produces regression back to an animal level, to the herd. So there's no justification for telling that secret, for giving out that strong meat, that every individual is really centered with spirit and initiative. And therefore, Paul said, you cannot yet bear it. If I tell you this now, he said, you won't form a church, you'll rush about doing what you think you want. And it will be to your detriment, because you should be moving towards integration. So because a man would not make a pyramid in himself, set up his ideas in an order of importance in himself as an individual, therefore a social hierarchy had to be set up to constrain him into behavior. So that society represents as a whole one man who has attained some order. And the individuals who accept that social thing because they know of no better are simply little bricks in that social pyramid. And they have abandoned their free initiative and conformed to the social pattern. Most of the theologians who think about morality and ethics are always talking about this kingdom of God in which everybody will have his position in the hierarchy of spiritual values. But there is no hierarchy of spiritual values other than the degree to which you have attained free initiative. Now, quite obviously, you cannot talk to people in large numbers and tell them the fundamental fact of the riddle of Samson, that out of the eater came forth me at, that you are the product of your own initiative, that you are yourself in character, in capacities, in talents, the product of the spirit which is involved into you and even now characterizes you with further purposes, and that nobody else can be blamed. In fact, the idea of blaming anything whatever, including spirit, is a waste of an idea, because the spirit is eternal and absolute and can never cease to exist, and is faced with the problem either to be or not to be, and it resolves it by being in the circle and not being out of it. The man who identifies only with the being and not with the non-being goes under the law of being. The man who identifies with the non-being as well is aware that his physical body is a machine. And he doesn't mind it being a machine any more than a man with a motor car minds his motor car being a machine. Your body is such a vehicle. The man who identifies with the body frequently does mind its mechanical limitations. And when he minds it, he resents the limitations. When he resents it, he contracts. When he contracts, he decreases his efficiency. The cure is always to remember your spiritual origin, your transcendence. Some philosophers actually think that transcendence is a meaningless term. They insult it. Materialists in general do so. But not only those, there are others that think that all that is being. And that the non-being is a matter of no importance. Therefore, don't think about it. Now, in fact, all that is being. And the non-being is a matter of no importance. Therefore, you ought to export yourself into it. Not import yourself. Export yourself out of that which has been imported already. Remember your original source.
It's only your feeling of self-importance that usually is put in the first
place. Of course, self-defense of the finite. When you realize that to defend the finite is futile because it ultimately must fail through lack of energy. And therefore, if you will place yourself in the infinite, you cannot fail. So the Tao Te King says, he who does not declare his aim cannot be said to fail. So if you will not say what your aim is in the gross material world, nobody can say you fail. They might say you're a loafer. They can't say you fail. If you know what it is you're looking for, namely reflexive self-consciousness, you can use your finite body as a piece of irritable protoplasm responding to stimuli of various orders and giving you occasion to meditate upon your own significance as a being of initiative. As you become progressively more and more aware of your spiritual source, your free source, you will understand more and more that you can do anything whatever that you will. And don't let's say anything that you want, because want implies deficiency. Anything that you will, and then you can understand Paul's statement that love is the law. And the statement, love and do what you will. That funny magician, Alistair Crowley, borrowed it and said, love is the law. Love and will is the law. The thing is, if you become a free being of initiative, there is no reason whatever why you should do one thing rather than another. But nevertheless, you will do certain things rather than some other things, simply because you will do those things to your ultimate benefit rather than to a temporal, finite, lower benefit. You will choose between values, and you will always choose those things that enhance your initiative and freedom.
Cases of that were very good, didn't
they? Cases of that?
I said the implications of
that. The implications?
Question, isn't it?
Well, it's strong meat.
Okay.
You know, one or two novelists have handled the idea of a man who suddenly becomes aware, after 30 years in a bank or something, that he didn't have to be there at all. He never did need to go there. He was conceptualized into going there. And because of the inherent insecurity in him, he accepted the concept. And then after many years, he discovers he didn't need to accept that concept. And then he breaks out of it. And everybody else in the environment immediately panics. They try to keep him in. Although the world will go on without him, they try to keep him in his conceptual position for the simple reason he is a finger pointing at them, saying, what are you doing here? If they can't replace him behind the counter, put him back and sit him on his chair and make him accept, their inner initiative will tend to spring out. And to be free is the same thing as to be exposed to danger. Because if you are free, you could do anything. And most people as such, to use the word technically, are terrified of being free, because when free, they could do anything. And when they could do anything, how do they know that they'll be all right when they've done it? So they prefer security. And security is the same thing as jail. Therefore, one thinker said, he who wants security, let him go and break a window. In public, he will immediately get security in jail. I met a man once in Piccadilly. He came up to me and said, excuse me, sir, do you mind giving me in charge to that policeman and tell him that I have bothered you and tried to get money out of you? And I said, what for? And he said, well, it's only a fortnight to Christmas, and when you're in jail at Christmas, you get very well treated. Well, you have to cast away all moral ethical considerations about this and consider your own level. That's how much initiative you feel you've got and how much you are prepared to face the implications of freedom. That a free act is an exposed act, anything can happen. Therefore, you have to decide how much you are prepared to expose yourself and how much you are prepared to pay the price, the results of your own actions. And there is no other law. Therefore, he said, the law is abrogated by grace. Grace is freedom. There's a very subtle dialectical trick in Christianity. It is the trick of making the thing you hate the thing you love. That actually can be done. If you understand the essential polarity of love and hate, you can actually do a very, very funny thing. You can actually love the hateful. You often find in the great artists a preoccupation with painting or modelling, sculpting. Ugly things, little distorted dwarfs and things. Things that people would say, those are not beautiful. And we can tell the level of a person by the way he reacts to that kind of art. If he said, good gracious, I can't stand that, we know that he is at a low level of freedom. He hasn't understood the meaning of ugliness. He hasn't understood the jester, the idiot in the court. He hasn't understood the dwarf, the little distorted creature, being allowed to run about the court in the presence of the most noble fellow with the best physical proportions. And he knew that the other man, by his ugliness, was going to be taken care of as surely as the other man was being taken care of by his beauty. And therefore to affirm the evil, the ugly, the wicked, and so on, is exactly valid as the good, the beautiful, the efficient, and so on. To see it that way changes your feeling until in the end you can do what the Absolute Spirit does. It loves deficiency as much as it loves sufficiency. And not with a feeling of pity at least. That's a great mistake. But actually to love it for what it is, at its own level. As an essential function, a mode of activity. You get a certain amount of tissue. You get more water than usual. And you make a head with it. And you've got a hydrocephalic. Now, a person with no water on the brain would think, that's terrible. But the person with that water on the brain hasn't got the same attitude to it, and can't have. He's aware that other people are pitying him, and he doesn't know why. He's vaguely aware that it's something to do with the size of his head, but he doesn't know why. People impose a concept on him that he's got a big head and it's full of water, and it should be cleaner. That is a statement of the average, it's a generality. And they're trying to impose a concept on him to make him feel awful. Whereas if they accepted him fully for what he was, he'd feel all right.
Well, the only thing I can understand with regards to this Roman hate business is a detachment of the poor.
No, you could do a great mistake if you were to become merely detached from it. That could place you in a position where you would never use your initiative. And all the great mystics have been aware of this trap. You see, when you dissociate from a thing, when you practice non-identification, you don't practice that in order to release yourself from unpleasantness. You should practice that for the sake of the truth, that all those modalities are not you. And then you can affirm the whole thing, not to hide yourself from it as unpleasant, but to will the whole structure as it is.
But as I say, I think the only way in which you can see it is it really is through detachment, because then there's no flux within yourself.
Well, this is a transition stage. In order to release yourself from the fear provocation of a distortion of form and ugliness, a lack of beauty or a disease and so on, is to practice non-identification. When you have gained it, you mustn't allow that to paralyze your initiative. There are men that have done that. We call them quietists. They get out of the situation and they vegetate. They become subhuman. You must still use your initiative when you have detached yourself.
You say that ugliness was necessary because without it we wouldn't have beauty.
Of course.
We have to have black to show the white.
Of course. That's the two ends of the stick again. You know, some very, very refined thinkers and men of aesthetic sensibilities have deliberately preferred ugliness in the ordinary sense of the term and revered it as beauty, as an act of will. Lord Byron did it. When he was in Italy, he found the daughter of the washerwoman. You see? Because he wanted to appreciate fully the refinement that was his own in his sensibilities. So he got a couple of shaggy bears and a rough girl in the house, and he contemplated them for what they were, not been discussed. That would be a terrible error. We contemplated them as modes of life, as shaggy bears and a washerwoman's daughter. And their nature allowed him to be himself, because they were other. And he wasn't ashamed of them, he wasn't sorry for them, he didn't pity them. He just saw them as they were, and thereby saw himself as he was, with the shaggy bear buried in him.
Surely the only way he can do this is through detachment.
Yes, but he mustn't allow that detachment to stop his free initiative. He mustn't do a pilot and wash his hands of the job. If he does, he'll come unstuck. You see, supposing you attain perfect vairagya, complete detachment, and you are a yogi, attained, you are going down the lane and you come to a little stream and you discover an old man has fallen over and at the moment is lying in the stream. Are you so detached that you don't pull him out of the stream? You see? There will always be an occasion presented to you whereby you will use your initiative. And quite detachedly, you'll take him out. In the story of the Round Table, Galahad is a detached man from this world because he is attached to the Holy Grail. And one of the things that annoys the other knights about him is this. Another knight gets into trouble and Galahad comes up and rescues him. And as soon as the man is safe, Galahad walks off. And he doesn't stay for thanks. And he doesn't say, "Lucky I came along, old boy." He just goes away. And the other knights were very annoyed and said, "Well, he's a stuffed shirt. Because he just rescued me and he didn't say anything." And an apology is made for him by Merlin, who says, "Well, after all, he's not human." You see? He is concentrated on the Grail. He wants free spirit. And he hasn't time to accept thanks. Now there's a peculiar kind of bondage that could tie people up. Very, very subtle. Everybody knows the bondage that people have when they have borrowed money from somebody and are indebted. When the debtor is indebted and feels indebted to the creditor. But much worse than that is when the creditor feels indebted to the debtor because he's done him a good turn. Supposing a man brings up his son and educates him and gives him every opportunity. Now when he's given him every opportunity, he tends, if he's not careful, to keep an eye on him so that he doesn't do something that daddy doesn't want. Daddy's identified with his success. And because he spent so much time on him, he wants to keep hold of him. He is the benefactor. And yet he wants to keep hold of the one he's benefited. That's very bad. If you do somebody a good turn, you will find in you a tendency to want to keep on good terms with the person you've done a good turn to. So that he can appreciate that you've done a good turn for him. So that you'd feel terrible if he turned away and left you. You would tend to follow him. Because you had done a good turn to him. And that's a terrible bondage. Much more subtle than the other one. If you can let go of somebody to whom you've done a good turn and don't care if you never see them again, you're much more free than the person to whom you are indebted is from you, when he can let go of you although you've helped him. And the psychological reason is that if you do somebody a good turn, you tend to think about him as somehow flying your flag. So you tend to keep an eye on him to see he doesn't do something to disgrace you, considering that you did him a good turn.
But all the time in these things, your best chances are through detachment.
Yes, but your detachment, when it is perfected, must never be allowed to paralyze your initiative.
An example I was thinking of, for instance, is if a person sees something someone knocked down and badly hurt their shot, they stand paralysed. The other person can see someone hurt, and because they're not affected by it, they can get along and look at a good one.
Well, then their detachment has been the occasion whereby their initiative could operate.
But in one case, it's through the detachment that made it possible for them to operate.
Yes, but the danger exists that when you are detached, you may do nothing. You may, in perfect detachment, you might see somebody knocked down in the street and just come to blame you. And say, this is a world in which people get knocked down. That can happen. It has happened to some people. Some people actually have glorified it. They have come to play to the battlefield and not bothered to give somebody a drink of water. That is the danger. Non-identification has got to be practiced because it is the only way that you can get free initiative. But you have to know that when you've got it, you must use your initiative. And remember, there's nothing to constrain you. Because if you're free, you're free. Therefore, you don't have to use your initiative. But if you had a faulty concept that you are practicing non-identification in order to stop all initiative, you would just contemplate the world. And there's a certain branch of yoga that made that error very strongly. And there are certain Greek philosophers who did the same thing. They said the highest conceivable activity for a human being is to contemplate without interfering. And then they got a school of contemplators. And while they were contemplating, the city fell down on their ears. And the soldiers of the enemy came in and saw them contemplating and carried them away, and their contemplation was interrupted. And then they said, well, now what were you doing when we caught you? We were contemplating. Oh, well, will you please teach our children to contemplate too? So they became teachers. Either that or their heads were cut off, so their contemplation was interrupted. And one or two of them were very clever, and they said, we accept the job, and they taught the children to contemplate. The result was that society also degenerated, and then some more enemies came in and captured them. And this quietism, this statement that contemplation is enough without initiative, has caused many societies to crumble, where intellectualism has grown and the contemplation of abstract truth has grown. And meanwhile, the world was corrupting, was rotting. When Nietzsche saw the state of the world, he saw it corrupting through this kind of activity. When Kierkegaard looked at the world, he saw it corrupting through that activity. There was a detachment of the intellectuals. Meanwhile, the place was rotting underneath. He saw revolutions and wars ahead necessarily because of this corruption. And he shouted out a warning. The place is corrupting through this detachment. We must use our initiative. Single-handed, he attacked the church. It cost him his life. Today, he is the existentialist philosopher that all the church leaders are studying like mad to try to find out how it is that the church became emptied, why they've got no power. And the answer was because they have detached themselves from reality and contemplated the situation comfortably from the bishop's chair. The man who detaches himself and doesn't use his initiative will find that other beings will use their initiative and they will interfere with him. Remember, if everybody were asleep, it would be all right. And if one man wakes up, all the other sleepers are in danger. And it's no good the dozy ones complaining. In order to formulate a complaint, they have to become educated. And that depends on the educator's will to educate them. You should work like mad to detach yourself, because the attached, the identified mode gets you into trouble, into foolishnesses and wastes of time. But if you detach yourself, you should remember that you are now a free being and you must do something with your freedom. If you don't, someone else will do it to you.
This is when you select what is your real task, is that what you...
Of course, yes. There's something in you, if you find it, that the world needs, and that you need to express. Remember, you can never find that thing by thinking from empirical data. That's impossible. That thing springs out of your centre of free initiative. When Christ chose his disciples, he deliberately chose fishermen and fellows who were not over-intellectualized, because only in such people was it easy to bring out of their centres their particular contributions. But to the over-intellectualized, the over-educated of his day, he had nothing to say except you're a lot of old bottles. What you have to do is this. When you were born, you were innocent. After a time, you became educated and therefore ignorant. You have to regain that innocence, because that innocence is exactly the same as free initiative. The educated, ignorant person is a bundle of conditioned reflexes and can only operate mechanically. But the person who wills innocence, like a child has, who wills it, is a free being, a being of spirit. And between those two innocences, the spontaneous innocence of the child and the willed innocence of the attained man, there is only a bundle of conditioned reflexes banging against another bundle and responding mechanically to it.
Nevertheless, that's a very hard and stony road once again, isn't it? Because I mean, all the time you're all living back to innocence, you're giving everybody the opportunity to have their big sort of thing, aren't you?
That's exactly what Christ said. He said it's straight and narrow. It's a hard road because the masses are not going that way. And they ought to be going that way, really. So if you start going that way and they see it, they're going to do their level best to pull you down. Because otherwise you're a finger pointing at them. And you have to decide whether you'll be mud with them or whether you will model yourself into a piece of sculpture and stand up to be thrown at. Now, if you prefer to be mud, all right. But it's a decision you have to make. And as you become more conscious of it, you become loaded more and more and more with guilt if you do not choose to be free. Once you become aware that freedom is possible for you, if you reject it, you'll feel awful. And the more refined and sensitive you become, the worse you will feel, unless you will to be free. And when you will to be free, then you will feel all right. But if you try to dump the results of freedom, you will feel bad. Which would you rather feel bad for, because you're a man, or because you are sculpted?
This is the moulding in of it to the still centre and out the furniture. You say we must be free by non-identification.
Yeah.
That is the still centre.
Yeah.
And then we must retain initiative. We can only apply that at the perimeter, can't we?
You insert into the material world, into the temporal world, that which you have attained in the eternal world. Remember, time is inside eternity. When you go into your centre, you are going in. I'll draw a perspective of it. This is you in this diagram. When you go into your centre, what you find is instead of an action band here, which is the product of the five sense activities, you find a hole and you go through that hole into spirit, and that is free initiative. And then you bring out of that spirit into the time process
That change of action. And nobody can tell in the action band, in their mind, what you're going to do. Therefore, Christ says, the spirit blows where the wrist is. You hear it. You don't know where it came from or goes to. You just hear it whistling through. That free initiative can do things, can change situations. Also, you could stand still with it if you wanted and do nothing. But you should do something with it, because it is an absolute power. And not to do something with it is not to use that which could be used. But the mode in which you use it is so subtle that nobody on the outside could possibly tell what you were doing. And nevertheless, you'd be acting as a cause all the time, because the spirit is the cause, and this is the effect. So a being here, preoccupied with the five sense data and the action then there, would be unaware of that centre of free initiative in itself, and therefore it would require you to conform to the mechanical pattern of its action then. And if you didn't, it would be upset and say you're unreliable. It must always say that. The purely routine being must always consider that the spiritually free man is unreliable. And this is not to confuse the spiritually free man with the unreliable man who is in the action band and whose action band is in a mess. You can be unreliable in two ways. One through simple mechanical inefficiency, and one because you are free. And this man cannot tell. The man involved in the action band of the five senses cannot tell whether your inefficiency or your non-action or your interference or your changes are dictated by mechanical inefficiency or free spirit.
For this one to appreciate what he would previously define as the unreliability in the free one is an indication that he is already moving towards that particular state himself.
Oh yes, he must have felt.
Even though he doesn't necessarily understand that unreliability, to say there is a value in that unreliability,
He must have become aware of that spirit in himself before he could allow even the remotest possibility of it.
That is an indication, isn't it? When someone can actually make that statement, though they don't.
He's already loosed himself from this mechanical band before he can make that statement.
This would mean that Christ was unreliable and yet he is the only one we can rely on.
That's right, well, that's direct, you see. That's exactly the thing. The angels who set fire to the city of London and thus destroyed the plague were unreliable from the point of view of fellows interested in maintaining a city full of disease. You know that if you read the history of that, you'll find that the dear powers that existed then, the monarchy and its administrative, actually went about interfering with the attempts to put the fire out. That fire killed a plague situation. There were some angels. Angel means messenger. Never worry for the moment whether it's a gross material body or not, because spirit operates through gross material bodies. They were angels. They were messengers of spirit that said the place wants cleaning up. There were angels who went to Sodom and set fire to it, and who told Lot to get out before they set fire to it. Angel means messenger. It doesn't matter if he's in a gross material body or not. He may be. As long as he brings a message of free initiative, he is an angel. That's why Thomas Aquinas is called the angelic doctor, because he gave them a message.
Would you say that Christ has still not escaped that law of opposites? He's done as much evil as he's done good.
Obviously. One of the things levelled against Christ is that he caused 2,000 years of terrible conflict, with millions of people killed in his name. You know, one dialectician said he died for every man, and since then every man has died for him. You see, that it's a fact, a dialectical fact, and it isn't finished yet. We've still got to fight a colossal war in his name. And the churches are still trying to gather themselves together to get the unity to do it. When they get it, they will do it.
That is dialectics. And that is an unavoidable, absolutely essential necessity. To try to regard it is just a waste of time. To accept it, to affirm it, and to penetrate to the meaning of it is just right.